Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Chicago Business Podcast. I am your host, Drew Sekula, and today we welcome Jim Jepcik, the CFO of Optimist Solutions. Jim's had an interesting career path across public and private equity-backed companies and has some great stories to share with us here today. He has been recognized as CFO of the Year by the Chicago chapter of Financial Executives International, and he's had a long and storied career that he's happy to share with us today. So thank you for listening, and please enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Chicago Business Podcast. Today we welcome Jim Jepcik, the Chief Financial Officer of Optimist Solutions, the leading global distributor and service provider of fastening and supply chain solutions for manufacturers seeking to improve efficiency and profitability. Thanks for joining us today, Jim.
Thanks for having me, Drew.
Great to have you on. We met just about a year ago at a networking event there with the Financial Executives International. It was actually a fun golf event. And have seen each other a few times since then in different networking activities. So, but unfortunately, not recently. So, nice to see your friendly face, and hopefully we'll be able to get together in person soon.
Absolutely. It certainly is a different world than the last time we saw each other. So, hopefully one day soon we'll be able to do it again.
Yep. Sounds good. If we could start off, you know what? I do like to begin with the beverage of the day. Today, we are keeping it simple. So I'll let you introduce it.
This is I believe it's a Nestle, whatever the brand name is, of water. Nothing simple. I like to stay hydrated during the day. So this is probably number 7. And my drink of choice during the day.
Yeah, me too. So drinking water here and enjoying it. It's been been trying to drink more of it. Get your gallons in during the day. So
right,
nice. Well, if you could start by maybe taking us through your origin story a little bit and talk about your kind of your initial connections to Chicago and briefly touch on your career journey. I'm gonna definitely, we'll dig into some of the professional career, over time, but if you could kind of give us a high level overview to start, that would be great.
Sure, I was born and raised in Chicago and have spent just about most 95% of my life living and working in the Chicago area. Schooling, of course, local with that, Loyola University undergrad, DePaul Graduate School. Right now, and for the last 32 years, I call home Elmhurst, Illinois, western suburb. Over the last 30 plus years in my career, has really seen and focused on the manufacturing and distribution sectors. Some brand name stops, if you will, along the way include Grainger. Spent 9 years at Grainger, Oil Dry Corporation in the late 90s. My first CFO role came in 2000 at a industrial supply distributor and manufacturer in Des Plaines called Duall Company. And then after that, have had a few more stops all within the private equity ownership landscape. So pretty happy with being able to enjoy career stops that have been for just about, for the most part, just really challenging, rewarding, just a lot of fun. I love what I do, and it's all kind of coming together here at Optimist. I've been here since September of this year, and it's been just a really, really interesting ride. And I enjoy improvements, mentoring teams, developing teams, coaching teams, helping businesses achieve maybe something they thought they couldn't achieve before. And certainly there were a lot of successes even in the first few months, I have to say, myself and the team here at Optimus, until a little roadblock called COVID-19 popped up in late March.
Right. I thought I heard you say September of this year, but obviously it was September 2019, right?
It was. Yes, for sure.
Just throw me for a little loop there. But yeah, that's great in terms of the how things are going there at your with your current stop. The with that progression that you've seen kind of over time, then the you obviously I was doing a little research, and looks like you did. You start an internal audit and then moved in through controller roles, or what? Yeah, kind of take us through a little bit more details on that progression.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was my start in internal audit back in the early 80s. CFS Continental, which was a pre-acquisition of Sysco Foods. So I started there, worked for internal audit a couple years, just got a really good feel for the business. It was food service, distribution, manufacturing. An opportunity arose in mid-80s to kind of get my first shop, if you want to call it that. And I took a role as plant controller in Fresno, California. So that was really exciting to set up cost accounting systems there. And if you're somewhat of a nerd number when it comes to manufacturing metrics, it was a perfect role, and I really enjoyed it. Did a good job. Was promoted then into a controller, divisional controllership in Orlando. Spent another year there, and then returned home, where after a stint with Sargent Welch Scientific, I was fortunate enough to land a role with Grainger, and had a nice long run there. Just met some lifelong business associates, friends, learned a ton. You know, as I mentor people, I always try and tell them, if you have the opportunity, you should always try to get a role in a world-class business such as Grainger. That'll help you a lot when you're in something other than a world-class situation to know what you have to work towards. So really, really excited about my time at Grainger. Grainger, very big, very successful, large number of CPAs. I decided I wanted to kind of branch out a little bit more and take the lead, have the lead role in on the accounting side within a publicly traded company. So was fortunate enough to get a role at as VP corporate controller at Oil Dry Corporation of America, located in the Wrigley Building in the city. Just a terrific organization, great team, great ownership. Publicly traded, but most of the shares were held by the by a family, and can't say enough great things about the role there, how the ownership group managed and encouraged and motivated the employees. It was a great learning experience from that experience, from that perspective, I should say, as well as it was from just the educational knowledge that I picked up in with multi-plant manufacturing environment, as well as SEC reporting. So it was a great experience. Again, had how these things happen. You get a phone call one day, and kind of the dream would always be to be a CFO. And my first opportunity to do so was in 2000 with, as mentioned before, Dewall Company, kind of leading distributor of industrial supplies, mainly within the cutting tool environment. They were located at the time in Des Plaines, I believe, and they're Wheeling now. And again, just had I guess to sum it up in one word, the buck stops here. One of the first things I learned as CFO. There's no one to take your problems to. You've got to, for the most part, solve them on your own. And so it was important to make sure I had a good team surrounding me, and building that team at Duol was probably one of the most important things and a great lesson that I learned, but how important that was to make sure you've got the right mix of people supporting you. After 5 years there, I was interested in the private equity side of ownership, having been through publicly traded companies, family companies, so that I'd give the private equity world a spin. And it was, again, you know, you think you get to a certain point in your career and you're pretty comfortable in knowing just about all you need. But in certain situations, certainly any liquidity challenge business, really important for you to have a solid handle on cash, right? And so that was the big learning exercise that I went through while at my first private equity stop. Just a great company, great ownership group. And, unlike maybe some of my peers working in more, let's just call it structured corporate environments, the balance sheet became very, very important, as anyone who's walked down that liquidity path, and certainly people in the last few months have been there as well, to know how important it is to not only obviously to acquire cash and keep cash, but to measure it. And the concept of a 13-week cash flow, which up to that point in time really hadn't been on my radar screen, popped up big, and it popped up very significantly. So I urge, as I talk to my peers, even if you don't think you need one, it has to be kind of a piece of fundamental building block of your total metric performance dashboard, if you want to call it that. And just the exercise of building one just creates a lot more knowledge about where the inflows and outflows of cash. The cliche, cash is king, obviously is true. And the more you're on top of it, the less likely bad things will happen. Let's just put it that way. So
yeah, there's a lot of companies that learn the lesson the hard way, I imagine, out there with what we've gone through. I mean, I guess you have the exercise of having done it, but there's also a difference between having a process in place and then, one thing about projections is you know that they're always going to be wrong, though, too. You know, you can get them close, but they're not going to be right on. But certainly the companies out there here recently that had those processes in place were much better positioned to withstand. You know, they know where the money is coming from specifically, as opposed to scrambling. I know that, I had lived some of the pain of that in a prior cycle with a particular business, and it was definitely challenging. It was a smaller business. We didn't have that process in place, and when one of our revenue sources had dried up for an intermittent period of time, unexpectedly, we were sent scrambling there for a little bit. And so I've seen that in action and in a few different scenarios in terms of the need for that. But in private equity, it seems like there's especially a focus on that. Has that been is that generally because of the leverage that's involved, or why do you think, or is it just a more refined set of metrics that they're working with, or why do you think private equity has a specific focus on that?
Yeah, so I think a couple of reasons, and you hit the nail on the head. Certainly, the leverage aspect has a lot to do with that. Sometimes things are a little bit tighter. You're usually working in a asset-based lending world, but what I said earlier too, I think is important. I think equity sponsors would agree. You have more control, and the more knowledge you have about where cash is coming and going, the more you can do that, the more you can be, master of your own destiny, so to speak. So I think that's really important. It's the best way to really understand how the business is flowing. Again, at the end of the day, everything eventually ends up to be a cash world. So I think it's probably for both of those reasons that there's such an emphasis on equity. And I'll just add one more thing, Drew, and probably in your case, you know, if you don't think you need it, that's probably the time you need it, right? Because when it does come time, when there's a problem, it's possibly, I don't want to say too late, but it's really difficult then to try and scramble and pull something together when there's more pressure from a liquidity perspective.
Right. Yep, I definitely agree with you there. It's interesting also the kind of bridge between there and then, you know, the importance of, or the focus on EBITDA numbers within private equity, because they're, you know, they're, you know, related but quite different too when you look at cash inflows and cash outflows versus you know, some of the all the metrics that are run based off of EBITDAs and valuations. It's interesting. I've always found the that focus on EBITDA because of the continued capital expenditures that are usually required in kind of keeping a business at least growing, right? You know, there's not necessarily a one-to-one bridge there, but, you know, a separate set of metrics that obviously get a huge amount of focus, you know, from the private equity firms, probably more so than what you might find in more in a family-owned, closely held business or you know, in public is maybe somewhere in between.
Is that for sure? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, obviously, 13-week cash flow in my mind is number one on a list. EBITDA is another measure, but as you pointed out, it doesn't pull in all aspects of cash. And then there's, of course, net working capital, how you manage your inventory, receivables, payables, depending upon the nature of your business. Incredibly important. You could, an EBITDA number may be acceptable, but if it comes to the cost of too much of a use of networking capital, you know, perhaps the investment or that customer may not be as attractive as you think it is. And it's part of your dynamic to get to an exit point that really maximizes the multiple values that the ownership would like to get to, you know, 2.5-3 times invested capital, something in that range. So yeah, there's some really key things to keep an eye on that just don't get measured with EBITDA. Although obviously as a proxy for cash flow within a P&L, it's probably the best tool out there.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what other observations do you have about kind of, yeah, the differences in working between the kind of the three different groups there with, we've talked, you know, a good amount about private equity, but your experience with family businesses and in the public corporations, I guess, public, obviously you get, I'll let you answer the question.
So there's, of course, all three kind of different dynamics. You know, I'll just say, and I've worked for a number, more than two family companies in experience. And, you know, I always tell people the good news is I work for a family run company. The bad news is I work for a family run company. It can cut both ways. And I've seen it both. And I mentioned that example of in the late 90s with Oil Dry. That's the good way, right? When there's that inherent desire of every single person working for the family to execute, do their job, to maximize their contribution, almost just as much for to the benefit of the family that owns the you know, has invested the capital, as much as it is for yourself. When that happens, you know, you really have a really good structure in place. And it probably goes for any good manager as well, right? The ones who elicit that type of commitment from their employees, that type of leader, that is usually the most successful. Not an easy thing to do, but that's kind of the similarities in between, I would say, family run business and maybe just a normal corporate role where there's you know, a number of different managerial levels at play. Publicly traded, and actually at Optimus, we're kind of quasi. We have some public debt, and you know, it's just a little bit different approach. Animal, it's a little bit more focused on non-EBITDA drivers. Let's put it that way. I wouldn't say it's any more challenging. Just different. It adds another layer of thinking and thought and workflow added to the process. And then just private equity in general, it's a space I really enjoy. I love the immediacy, the focus, directional, collaborative. You really feel like you're part of valuation growth. And that's what really, really gets me excited about the about that type of role. So all different and all good in their own right. Just a matter of what you're looking to maximize your own performance from.
Right. So in so doing and trying to create that additional value, there's kind of always been that that balance from a finance leadership perspective of the keep us out of trouble end of it to make our business better. How have you kind of balanced those, and where do you how do you do both with limited resources?
So I think it's really boils down to I'll use the word efficiency, productivity. But the experiences I've had, there's been some, I'll just use the word tarnish or performance treading in the water, so to speak, and maybe things haven't developed as beneficial to the ownership group from a valuation perspective as they thought when they bought the business. So usually what I do when I come in is to take a look at the entire business, but I'll start with the finance team and just really scratch my head and you know, just ask why do we have these people doing these roles? What's the process involved here? And the example I always use is businesses grow over time. If not managed properly, it becomes like a game of Tetris. I don't know, Drew, if you remember that.
Yeah.
The blocks coming down, and initially they come down very smooth and even, everything fits, no spaces, and then as the game speeds up, it's more difficult to flip things around, and you end up with a lot of holes, a lot of inefficient laying of those bricks until you lose the game, right? It times out. So that happens a lot with many businesses, at least what I've seen, and the key is to go back in and really figure out exactly where the workflow is, what resources do you need on that. If you've got three people working at, say, maybe 60% of their potential capacity, let's put it that way, does it make sense for that to happen? Are there process impingements that can really make that two, and the third person can have an opportunity to be used as a resource somewhere else in the business? That's really the first. The first step, once you get the lay of the land and understand the what's driving the activities within the organization, and that's when going kind of the interesting things start, and that's when you start seeing the aha moments on people's faces when they realize that what they've been doing all along, someone else across the hall was doing, kind of repeating their work for no apparent reason other than they didn't know that they were doing the same work. So, and I've had a few examples of that, as well as some other, let's just call them redundancies in my experience. So just that really kind of roll up your sleeves and peeling away the onion layers. Because when you don't do that, that's when that Tetris game gets out of hand. And you don't really fully leverage the most important asset that you have, the people at your organization. You're not able to leverage them and what they can contribute to the business as well as you should be able to.
Seems like that's a big piece of what you guys do there at Optimus Solutions as well, right? You have kind of multiple layers to the business, but you're a big manufacturer as well as driving efficiencies out of, I'll let you explain it, but in the research I was doing, it looked like there was a fair amount of that profit enhancement work going on as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do manufacture, although we're primarily a distributor. We have a manufacturing facility in Wooddale, Illinois, and then one in Barton in the United Kingdom. And you're correct. That's what we bring to the table, especially for some of our large OEM customers. We serve companies like Navistar and Cummins Engine and Packard, Jaguar Land Rover, Ford in Turkey. And what we do is to help those companies get even more efficient, as good of the job as doing, help them get more efficient on their shop floor and their production facilities. And we do that by embedding our own people and helping them manage their own inventory, VMI, vendor managed inventory. And literally, and these aren't clerical people, these are engineers we have in-house helping the team, our customers' teams, to maximize what their performance is. We even have that built into our the agreements that we have, that we are committed to finding hard dollar savings that we'll share with our customers. So it's been a really great business model, and we've been very pleased with the results. And again, you're not going to be great without great customers. So and we're fortunate to have those.
Right. Yeah, that's seems like it's ever more important driver of business results that we have these days, in terms of just trying to drive the efficiencies out. I guess it's always been important, but never more so than now. What other kind of innovation trends are you seeing out there, both with the business and more with respect to the business than but you can also touch on within finance as well.
Yeah, so we've, as many companies have, we're a part of that exercise too. E-commerce is big. We've maybe a little bit more so than some of our competitors. I've got a very robust e-commerce site. I was just looking at it last week, and it's just really amazing what our IT team has done to pull that together. And we think that's really going to be leverageable in the future. Not knowing exactly what the world landscape is going to look like, we've also are exploring MRO, safety supplies, more so than we have done so in the past. And I think given our platform, our breadth of resources and talents, engineering team and sales team, I think that's going to be a big opportunity for us to grow in the future. On the finance side, we have plans to launch a new ERP. Already the groundwork's laid, already having preliminary meetings. So kicked off last week, and I would say for the next year and a half, that's probably our goal, what we want to try to get accomplished. So it's we have multiple systems scattered across the globe. We operate in 15 countries. Some of those countries have multiple ERPs in and of themselves. So it's going to be great to be able to for everyone to be on the same platform, work together, collaborate together, regardless of what country they're in, what time zone they're in. So I'm really looking forward to that. I think that's going to be a big benefit to us going forward as we look to continue to maximize our valuation.
Yeah, that's a huge project for you guys, I'm sure. How much of that are you doing in-house versus bringing in outside folks for it to help with the migration?
Yeah, so most of the work will be done in-house. We do have a group coming in to help us with the planning, some of the execution. We're not doing it complete, everything from quote to cash all the way to the end target, but all the key elements, particularly on the finance side, will be part of the new ERP.
Yeah, well, that's plenty to bite off over 18 months. That's usually pretty quick but I'm sure the process for that started quite some time ago.
It did, yes.
So maybe we can move on to a little bit and talk about how the pandemic and COVID-19 has affected your business.
Yes, you know, I don't know how many times I've used the word unprecedented, like everyone else has. I'm sure you have, Drew. This goes without saying. Never would have thought that we were going to be in a position that we were in. And I'll be honest with you, I think the reactions that we took in collaboration with our ownership group were swift. They were impactful. I'm not just saying this, but I'm just really pleased with the way, all things considered, how it all played out. We immediately jumped on a number of different initiatives to make sure that our strong liquidity position was secure. It was a great collaboration from our credit partners, and probably the wild card there that was I wasn't exactly sure how that was going to go is obviously we were on quarantine, stay at home. This is a relatively new management team, so we really didn't have a chance to have a long runway to work together when we found ourselves all apart. And I just can't impress, as I said, our ownership group, but also our CEO TJ Rosengarth, who's just been really excellent in keeping the band together and playing the instruments all in harmony as much as we could. My team, again, after perhaps the first week to 10 days of just trying to figure out how do we communicate with each other, and I'm a very much a, I would just call it a water cooler guy talk type of guy. So I really enjoy just walking past someone's office, poking my head in there, start talking, see how things are going, and you learn, right? Obviously, that was not possible as we were on quarantine. So I'm not a big fan of repetitive meetings, but I changed my tune. And every day, 11 o'clock in the morning, and that's with half my team here in the U.S., half the team in the U.K., we would have a meeting. And that meeting sometimes was nothing more than me just updating him from what I knew, what was going on, to maybe a full-blown hour and a half discussion about how do we improve, how do we get better, how do we get the flow of information from the U.S. side to the U.K. side, from the FP&A side to the Treasury side. So it was a new way of managing for me. And I think talk about an old dog learning new tricks. It was definitely an eye-opener, and one that initially I wasn't quite sure how successful it was, but after about the fourth or fifth week into quarantine, one of my UK employees said that she's never felt more connected, and she's been with the company for a long time. I've never felt more connected than I've been within the last 4 or 5 weeks. So big learning lesson for me, for everyone, and to this, it's one of the things we've carried over now that we're at least in the US, we're back together, all in the office here in Glenview. It's been a real, I said eye opener before, but it was just a very positive movement towards how to manage when maybe you aren't all in the same room together. I think that part is what we learned the most about each other. So overall, just a really good experience. And you just never know when things look, and we saw some lower volumes in April, partial recovery in May, and now going into this last week of June, things are going pretty well, all things considered. So we're on a good pace at the end of, in the middle of the end of Q1, things were starting to pick up, new management team really executing. And it was almost palpable. You can feel the excitement building, and then things just shut down. So I'm happy to say things that excitement is building back up again. I was just in a meeting today. It was just it gets your hair standing up on your arm, right? How optimistic you feel about where things are heading.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear that you guys didn't take too big of a dip there for too long. You know, Obviously, all sorts of businesses were impacted in different ways. So,
absolutely,
you guys were probably positioned well in your industry and in your field that it was a little bit more modest hit than some. In terms of going back into the office, so
Did that require, you have to reconfigure any space or do anything? How much work did that all entail for you guys?
So as a essential business, we never fully closed the office, but we were very cognizant and aware of concern that everyone had, including myself, from a safety and health perspective. When we did decide to optionally allow people to come back in, we've got a terrific senior VP of Human Resources, Kate Daly. She laid out the protocol along with our legal counsel, Riv Golden, and literally when you walked into the office from the first day, it was pretty restrictive, I have to say, in a good way. Arrows down the hallways. We are fortunate to have open space in parts of our office. So we scattered people about as much as possible. Very clear protocols, very clear rules, arrows pointing which way to walk so you don't come within 6 feet of anyone, masks on at all times, disinfectant wipes in every office, limits in terms of how many people in a conference room at one time, cleaning up as you go, obviously signs all over the place for the most important thing, which is wash your hands as often as you can. And then, of course, a check-in every day, temperature taken, questions asked about your health, how you're feeling, have you been in contact, where you've been, things like that. Every day, we still do that to this day and probably will for the foreseeable future. So it's been a very safe feeling process that we've put in place here. And I think everyone is comfortable that we're doing everything possible to be keep our employees safe and healthy.
Right. Yeah, that's sounds like you're doing everything you could, yeah. Everything you're supposed to be doing, a little bit extra, right? Just making sure that everybody's safe. So that's great that you guys were able to manage through that without too big of a impact, and that you had the additional space. Obviously, there's a lot of companies that are, you know, still working remotely because they haven't, they don't have the same flexibility in reconfiguring their spaces. So, well, that's great. I'd be remiss not to touch on your CFO of the Year award back, a couple years back now, or not even that. So maybe once you get back through, can you maybe talk just a little bit about, what the FEI does there and how you were recognized?
Yeah, so I would be remiss not to, and you've mentioned them a couple times, but Financial Executives International, FEI, just an incredible group. And the Chicago chapter has always been good and keeps on getting better year after year. I think about 9 years ago, they launched this CFO of the Year awards, I guess you would call it. Every time I talk about it, by the way, Drew, it's just I'm very proud, but it's I'm slightly embarrassed by it. Most CFOs, at least my peers that I'm aware of, we don't like the spotlight. We try to avoid it at all costs. And I remember sitting as I was one of the nominees, sitting there, just literally praying that I wouldn't get picked. So I wouldn't have to go up and, have this thank you note, which thankfully we were all told to prepare, before that evening. But, it's an award that, uses a number of different criteria, and a pretty exhaustive, discerning process, that, members of the, FEI, staff, as well as sponsors go through. I had, made a couple different discussions and interviews, but even as you're all, as the nominees all get together, probably about a month beforehand for a dinner, it was just a really, really positive, collaborative environment. You know that for everyone to be in that room, everyone won. Right? It was just, and I really do mean that. It was just amazing to see some of the talent that that's out there in the Chicago area, in particular for the CFO office. But it's, again, just a tribute to the FEI and their leadership, Maggie Mortensen and all the, key individuals driving success there that tells you how important that is, that organization is to, in particular the Chicago area. I'll focus on that. It's a really great, as you know, community. And the more we can get together and share and celebrate each other, that just helps us all grow even more. So very much a shock that I want, to be perfectly honest with you. Very pleased to have that, though, and very thankful.
Yeah, no, that's great. And yeah, we're in my interactions, you're definitely one of the guys that stands out. And so not surprising from an outsider perspective a little bit there that a guy like you would win something like that. So
that's very kind of you to say that. Thank you.
Last thing I'd like to touch on is just kind of involvement in the community and kind of volunteer type things. Saw that you've done some work with like the city of Elmhurst, I believe, and maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the things you do outside of the office as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you had mentioned the city of Elmhurst back in the Depression recession in 2009. Elmhurst, like many communities, was under a lot of pressure as revenue streams were drying up. So I was placed on a task force to review a number of their program spending activities to see where things could be leveraged as much as possible and to improve the overall financial health. Thankfully, Elmhurst was very healthy going into the exercise, and I think there were a number of things that we did to really help out a little bit. You know, wherever they could, you know, we were recommending trying to collaborate with other communities. You know, sometimes you have the independent administrative functions and. Elmhurst, I think, had been part of a DuPage County-wide effort to consolidate some of their emergency response services. So so that was really heartening. I was very happy and pleased to be able to give back a little bit to the community. A little more maybe on the another venue. I kind of greenfield and started a charity fun run. That was back in 2012, and we had that a number of years. And raising money for local pantries, pads, other type of services that were in need. So again, the goal there was to get the community together and be with each other, and along the way help out those who obviously need the help. And it's out there. It was out there then. It's out there now. We just need to keep on working hard to try and provide as much benefit to those. Who aren't as fortunate as we are to kind of pull them up as much as we can.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Jim, for sharing your story with us, and I really appreciate your time. And with that, I think we'll go ahead and bring it to a close. So.
Great. Well, thank you, Drew, and love the podcast. I was listening to a number of them, almost through all of them, and just very enjoyable. And thanks for bringing all those unique stories to everyone's ears. It's very helpful.
Thank you. Yeah, that's good feedback. I appreciate it. All right. Well, have a great rest of the day, and we'll be in touch. Hope to see you soon.
Great. Thanks, Drew. Same to you.
Yep. Take care.
Goodbye.